Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast, where we'll be discussing the March 2017 board meeting. My name is Matt Tilling, and I'm the Director of Education here at the Foundation. It's my pleasure to welcome once again the Chair of the International Accounting Standards Board, Hans Hugewurst, and Vice Chair Sue Lloyd. Hans, before we discuss the board's March meeting, we have had a number of other meetings in March, the Global Preparers Forum and the Capital Markets Advisory Committee. Can you tell me a little bit about these groups and how they relate to the ISB?
Yes, these are two very important standing advisory committees. We work a lot with advisory committees. If we develop a new standard, for example, a new insurance standard, then we will have a specific advisory committee consisting of specialists in the area. That will be disbanded once the insurance standard has been completed. But we also have standing committees, and these are the two most important ones. The Global Preparers Forum, well, the name says it all. It's a group of preparers, and they advise us on our standard, and of course they will use their preparer perspective. They will advise us on costs, on the way they feel it represents their performance. A very good group. And then we have the Capital Markets Advisory Committee. That's a group of investors, buy side, sell side, and they give us advice from the perspective of the investor community. And once a year, these two groups meet together and they mix their perspectives, and that's also usually a very good meeting. So a very important part of our due process.
Turning now to the board meeting, wider corporate reporting is becoming an increasingly important topic, not just here, but around the world. What has the board been discussing in this area?
Yeah, well, what you see in the last decade, I would say, is that annual reports are becoming more and more voluminous. That's not just the result of IFRS, as is commonly thought, but also the amount of non-financial reporting is getting bigger and bigger. Reporting about sustainability issues, reporting about how you deal with your employees. There are all sorts of non-financial reporting which are growing in importance. There's also a growing realization among the investor community that also non-financial value drivers of companies are critical for a good understanding of future profitability prospects. So obviously we are financial standard setters. We have no specialization in issues like climate change or sustainability more broader. So the question is there anything we can do? Well, we work already very closely with, for example, the IIRC, the Integrated Reporting Council, which advises companies as to how to put together an integrated, including non-financial information, annual report. We know this is important. Increasingly, people are looking at us. Is there something that you can do to address the a big issue in this non-financial reporting, which is that there is almost no international comparability. There are like 400 initiatives that occupy themselves with all sorts of non-financial reporting, and it is a bit of a chaos in the world. One thing that we could consider is whether we could update our management commentary practice statement, which is a non-mandatory guidance as to how to design your annual report, if we could update that for all these most recent trends into integrated reporting. That perhaps it could be the basis for a sort of a core report in which you pull together a lot of information, not just financial but also non-financial. It's a tricky area. The board is a bit cautious about entering this field. We really need more information, and we need to study this more carefully. But it is something we are looking at very seriously.
One area discussed at this month's board meeting was goodwill and impairment. And though no decisions were made, there looks like there's going to be some interesting issues discussed in the future, Sue.
Yes, so this was something we haven't talked about for a while, simply because of other things on our agenda and also a bit of a change in our staffing. So what the purpose of the discussion was to sort of pick this up again. This is work that we've been doing as a consequence of the post-implementation review of IFRS 3. And so really one of the purposes of the session was for the staff to get us back up to speed, remind us what we'd discussed before, and also what we can expect to see them bringing us back papers about over the next few months. And so, as you rightly say, some interesting topics will be coming back to us, and what we confirmed with the staff was that our initial focus is going to be to see if there's ways that we can simplify the impairment test in IAS 36 for impairment of assets, but without upsetting the timeliness of impairment. So it's a balancing act between those two things. And also another important area we'll be looking at will be the disclosure of information for investors who are looking at business combinations after the event. And the staff also confirmed that once we've gone through these discussions, we'll sort of look back at the feedback we got from the post-implementation review and sort of decide whether we think we've done enough to address the points. And one of the things we'll sort of recap on would be confirmation of the sort of tentative decisions we've made earlier about whether we should reconsider amortization of goodwill or stick with impairment of goodwill, which is sort of our working assumption at the moment.
Also, the board has completed its discussions of the research project on discount rates. What's the conclusions here?
So this was a project that we did following from our first agenda consultation, where people told us that there seemed to be some potential inconsistencies in how we use discount rates across our literature, and they really asked us to stop and review that. And so the staff have done a whole series of work since then, looking at how we do use discount rates in different standards and what the reasons are for the differences, and where in some standards there's more articulation of what the discount rates are than in others. And they've really documented their findings, and what they've found is that in most cases, as you would expect, the difference is because there's different measurement objectives. But also they've found that there are some things we could do to be more consistent and also to be more clear in how to set discount rates. So I think there's two consequences of this piece of work that the staff have done for the board. One is establishing some sort of best practice guidelines for the staff and the board going forward. When you're looking at discount rates and projects, what do you need to think about? What are the pitfalls that we need to watch for? And also what we're planning to do is to document the findings and put them in one place so that they're accessible for people to see going forward. And also, if we're going to do further discount rate work in the future, that we're all clear where we got to and what our basis is to move forward from that.
Hans, the board also received an update on insurance contracts. What's the news here?
Well, the news is that we are very close to finishing the standards. The ballot draft has been sent to the board members. The last comments are coming in, and we're making the whole standard ready for production. The standard will also be accompanied by a very extensive effect analysis, which will demonstrate very clearly why this standard is needed so much. All of this is now in production. That takes a little bit of time. It's not just a matter of putting it in a word processor and pushing the print button. We expect to publish the standard in the second half of May.
Sue, there was an item related to the conceptual framework and the upcoming amendments to paragraph 11 of IAS 8, specifically their application to rate-regulated activities. Can you tell us a little bit about the amendment and why is it particularly important for rate-regulated activities?
Okay, it's a bit of a geek's point, but I'll try not to make it too boring. So we decided previously that if people need to refer to the hierarchy in IAS 8, which tells people what to do in the absence of a specific IFRS standard, so the hierarchy in IAS 8 says if there's not specific guidance, look at other standards that may be on similar points, or if that doesn't exist, the other thing you can look at is our conceptual framework. And in January, we decided that in the future, in about 18 months' time, people will need to refer to the new conceptual framework rather than the old conceptual framework. But one of the questions that we left open that was then discussed at the recent board meeting was whether that should be the approach taken for rate regulation, in particular for regulatory account balances. And the reason why that was sort of singled out for special mention was that we believe there may be some instances today where people are using the conceptual framework to form the basis for their policies on this, and we've got an active project. So is it appropriate to ask people to look at a new conceptual framework when we're in the midst of changing the accounting and coming up with specific requirements? The board decided that we should actually prohibit people from using the new reference to the new conceptual framework. So there'll be an exception to the change in IS8 that basically says that you must continue to refer to the existing conceptual framework, today's conceptual framework, if you're looking at concepts as the basis for developing policies for regulatory account balances. So basically no consequence for them of the change in the definitions and concepts. And the other important thing that we discussed was the staff got confirmation from the board that they should proceed to draft the amendments arising from this. So both the conceptual framework and the sort of consequential amendments arising from that are now in the drafting process for publication later this year.
Hans, there was quite a bit of discussion about primary financial statements at this board meeting. Two subtotals were on the agenda, earnings before interest and tax, and management operating performance measures. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. So primary financial statements is a key part of the central theme of our work in the next couple of years, which is better communication in financial reporting. So we are looking specifically at improvements to the statements of financial performance and cash flows, and to make them better depict the financial performance of a company. Now, investors have told us, listen, you define revenue and you define profit or loss, but in between you don't define all that much, and we need more disaggregation, we would need subtotals that give better insight in the persistence of income so that we can better do our analysis. So that's what we're looking at. And one of the possibilities of a subtotal that we could define is a very commonly used one, which is earnings before interest and tax, EBIT. And you would say, well, that's quite simple. So you take earnings and you deduct interest and you deduct tax and then you have EBIT. Well, apparently it's not so simple, because you have interest coming from going through different sources, and you really want to focus on the interests related to the capital structure of the firm. And then the question,
whatever that might mean.
And whatever that might be, that's another question that we have to delve into. So nothing, unfortunately, is simple in accounting, but this is certainly something that we are going to take a very serious look at. Then it is also clear that a lot of companies are using their own adjusted performance criteria, and they especially present those performance measures in their investor packs, the special information for investors. And one thing that we are considering doing is telling companies, well, if you think those measures are so important, bring them into the financial statements, reconcile them with the IFRS numbers as you have them in the financial statements, so that everybody can very clearly see what the adjustments are that you make. And you know, a lot of companies make adjustments for income items that they see as temporary. I don't think we will be able to make very specific rules about what you can call temporary or not, but we might be able to design some more general guidance on when you use such terms, that you have to be able to demonstrate that indeed an item is unusual in terms of magnitude or in terms of frequency. Also, this is not going to be easy, but I think if we are going to be able to bring some more discipline to this and some more formatting, then we would do a huge service to the investor community. And I also think that preparers might find that helpful.
Another topic for discussion in the primary financial statements was guidance on classification, aggregation, and disaggregation.
Yes, so we've decided that there appears to be a need to develop clearer principles of aggregation and disaggregation, along with some guidance on this topics, and that will be considered at future board meetings. And finally, other issues that we will be looking at are adjusted basic earnings per shares. And we will also look at the question whether there are possibilities of better presenting other comprehensive income so that the investor can get a better grip on it. Other comprehensive income tends to be overlooked by investors. We feel it often contains important information. So we might look for ways to making it a little bit more prominent. And we will finally also look to improvements to the statement of cash flows.
So the final issue I'd like to consider is the financial instruments with the characteristics of equity project, or as we tend to refer to it, the FICE project. There were a couple of items here, but they related specifically to what's called the gamma approach. Here's a challenge for you. Can you explain the gamma approach to me in under 20 seconds?
Oof, under 20 seconds, oh, that's a condition. Okay, well, in short, the gamma approach says that an entity has a liability if it has one of two things happening, or both. Either an obligation to make a payment in cash or other financial assets, so writing a check, or if you've got an obligation to deliver value that is not connected to the changes in your own residual value. So if you've got an obligation to deliver $100 worth of your own shares, that also would be a liability under gamma.
Okay, so the discussion in the board was about the application of the gamma approach around derivatives in own equity and the interaction with other IFRS standards. Was there anything specific here that we should talk about?
I think it was a good illustration of gamma giving us an answer where we've got not much clarity under IAS 32 today. So it was all about what you do if you've got a group of companies where, say, the parent company has got a different functional currency to its subsidiary. So say I've got a parent company that's got a sterling functional currency and a subsidiary that's a euro functional currency. And the question is, if the parent entity says that it's going to sell shares in its subsidiary, and it says I'm going to sell shares and I'm going to sell you a fixed number of my subsidiary shares and I'm going to sell it in sterling, which is the parent's functional currency, and you're delivering subsidiary shares that are a euro entity shares, is that equity or not? And we said that you needed to have the same currency for the strike price of the derivative as for the shares that are being delivered under the contract. And because in my example there's a disconnect, that wouldn't be equity classified because it's not an obligation that is connected with the residual value of the entity shares, that second part of the test that I was talking about. So the short answer is that gamma would give us an answer which people will comment on and tell us whether they like or not, whereas it wasn't clear under IAS 32 today. We also looked at the interaction with other pieces of our literature. So for example, what were the implications of any of the decisions that we'd made on, for example, IFRS 9, and just confirmed what would be covered in the discussion paper. And this was another project where at last week's meeting the board completed its deliberations and asked the staff to move on to drafting a due process document, in this case a discussion paper, which again we would expect to be published around the end of this year.
Well, that ends our discussion of the board meeting, but before I let you go, Sue, this month you also officially took over as the chair of the Interpretations Committee.
I did. We had a good meeting. Interpretations Committee is a really important committee of the organisation. It's really got a lot of focus at the moment because one of our strategic objectives is to try and provide support to those who are implementing and applying our standards, and so it's got a really important role providing that assistance. And the good thing, I think, having the chair of that committee being a board member is it means that we can have a close working relationship between the two different bodies, and we can make sure that we're sort of on the same page. It was a really constructive meeting, and one of the things that we really tried to focus on in the meeting was making sure that even in circumstances where the committee concluded that there was enough information in the standards already to reach a conclusion, that we set out as much as we possibly could how we'd approach the question we'd been asked and what pieces of the literature people should refer to, what disclosures they should use, so that we give as much information to people to help them implement the standards as we can, even when we're not going to undertake more standard setting activity.
And I understand that in the future we might expect to see some more communication coming out of the Interpretations Committee, possibly even a podcast, so people should watch out for that.
Exactly.
Hans, finally, we have a couple of key events coming up soon. I was hoping you could tell us about those.
So, yes, we have an IFRS conference coming up in Amsterdam. We do one in Europe in a different country every year. We'll have a wide range of topics, including a three-hour workshop on the new insurance standard, which will be published by then. And we will also have a particular both focus in addition to specific accounting standards to wider corporate reporting, the issue that we just discussed earlier on. And I'm happy to say that I will be chairing a panel which includes the former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Jan-Peter Balkenende. He was Prime Minister of two cabinets that I was also a minister in. He is specialized in integrated reporting, sustainability reporting, so I'm sure he will be able to give a very good speech on that. And we will also have Richard Howard, the CEO of the International Integrated Reporting Council. There's also a LISES conference in London in May, and that will revisit the issues covered in last year's very successful conference. So you can find information on our website on all these conferences.
Well, thank you very much, Hans and Sue, and thank you very much to our listeners. A slightly longer podcast this week, and certainly we're always interested in any feedback. You can email us at communications@ifrs.org. As always, a full summary of the board's discussion and the decision at the March meeting can be found in
the ISD update. Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast.